You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the UK Prime Minister says accepting more refugees is not the way to solve Europe's migrant crisis. Instead, we should bring peace to the Middle East. We've got half an hour. Let's see if we can figure out how. Our studio guests George Brock and Stefan Sonning will discuss that. And as news desks ponder the rights and wrongs of publishing the starkest image yet of the migrant crisis, and social media broadcasts it anyway, we'll ask how far is too far when it comes to graphic but important pictures. Vladimir Putin goes to China again. Is his opinion that Sino-Russian relations are at an all-time peak correct? And is that altogether a good thing? And as Turkey arrests two more journalists and an Egyptian newspaper closes in curious circumstances, we'll look at what, if anything, governments gain by cracking down on media. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are George Brock, Professor of Journalism at City University here in London, and Stefan Sonning, Economics Correspondent with Sveriges Radio of Sweden. Welcome both. We will start tonight with Europe's unceasing migration crisis, an agonising question of law, morality, economics and politics to which nobody seems to have a good answer. British Prime Minister David Cameron at least believes he knows what the answer isn't, as he sees it, allowing increasing numbers of refugees to settle in Europe. Instead, he said today, he thinks the solution lies in bringing peace and stability to the places the refugees are fleeing. George, first of all, this is a possible new world record holder in the category of easier said than done, isn't it?
I'm not sure that any prime minister can really expect to be taken seriously if he says the answer to the migration crisis is not allowing more people in, it's having peace in the Middle East. No peace has existed in the Middle East during the whole of David Cameron's lifetime.
Or the previous 3,000 years
before
that.
And it's really not likely to happen now. On the other hand, I think that Cameron has more of a point. I mean, I think he's making a good point badly. I think he's right to concentrate us not on, or to try and shift everybody's gaze away from what's going on the borders of Europe to the Syrians who are outside of Syria in the immediate area, because that is actually the whole crisis. If Europe ends up letting in more people, it is quite possible that all it will do is increase the numbers of people who are sitting on the borders of Syria who think they can then get to Europe. And if he's pointing that out, then actually he's saying something quite not popular, but correct.
Stefan, the problem there, of course, he may well be correct that if you allow people in, then more of them will come. But it doesn't actually solve the problem, does it?
It does not. It absolutely does not. I think it's quite a strange statement. If I had been a journalist interviewing Mr. Cameron, I would have asked, since he's arguing, who actually is saying that the solution to the whole situation is giving refugees shelter? I've not heard anyone say that.
I mean, George, this may be crediting David Cameron with more joined up thinking than he was exhibiting in this particular interview. But is he trying to find a way to begin acknowledging what I think is the reality, that a large scale or a larger scale military intervention in Syria is an inevitability?
It's just possible he's trying to do that, although he's a very realistic man. I rather doubt that his chances of doing that are good. I think he's trying to move people's attention away. It's not that there's nothing that can be done. I mean, I think governments should be doing more for the countries that are absorbing these people, for example. One of the reasons why they want to get out of these places is they can't work in these refugee camps. Some of them aren't much places to live anyway, so they're leaking into the populations of quite fragile states like Jordan, which don't really want very large numbers of immigrants.
And Lebanon, a quarter of whose population is now refugees from Syria.
And so on and so forth. So if he's saying, look, guys, what we should really be concentrating on is helping these countries on Syria's border, I'm with him on that.
Stefan, how is this seen from Sweden? Not just Britain's attitude, but the crisis in general. Sweden has historically, certainly the last 20 years from Bosnia onwards, been much more generous than most countries in accepting and absorbing refugees. Although, curiously, in recent months, the very anti-immigration Sweden Democrats are now the most popular party in the country. Has Sweden, do you think, reached the limits of its tolerance, or does it just look at these crises in a different way to an island country like Britain?
Well, I absolutely do not think that that Sweden has reached any kind of limit when it comes to the refugee question. But as you say, and we are very generous. We are not one of the most generous. We are the most generous if you
in per capita terms.
Per capita terms, yes. So. But what is happening is that our society is more and more split, and it shows in the as you said, Sweden Democrats development. They got into the parliament two elections ago with 6%. In the last election, they got almost 13%, and according to the latest opinion polls, they will get almost 20%, and they're on route to become the biggest party in Sweden. So it's a huge question in Sweden, and it's splitting the society in quite dramatically, I would say.
George, do you get any sense at all, and we'll talk about shortly about a relatively new factor that may be beginning to shift mood in Britain, but Britain has so far agreed to take in maybe 1,000 refugees from Syria. As people have pointed out, you could barely fill a tube train with what Britain has offered to take. Germany's looking at taking 800,000 this year alone. Why is there that difference in attitudes? Is it just the islander mentality?
No. Andrew, I really don't think it is confined to Britain. Anyway, where I think the outrider here, the outlier, if you like, is Germany. Anti-immigration...
Germany's the exception and Britain's the rule.
Germany is the exception, yeah, and Britain is much
probably.
More the average.
Yeah.
Anti-immigration parties are gaining. You've just been talking about Sweden. They're gaining in the Netherlands. They're gaining in other Scandinavian countries, Finland included. I could go
Denmark
on...
Denmark as well.
I could make a longer list. Now, these aren't just happening... there's not a single cause for this. It's that the roughly the same process is happening in all of these places, and these politicians are, you know, of course they're hemmed in by this. That's what democracy is about. They have to take some account of what people think, even if they don't like it, and that's why they don't think that while they might be able to massage the numbers a bit, this is a crisis on a scale where none of the things that they think they're likely to be able to do in terms of acceptance inside their own country are really going to attack the main problem.
Well, let's look now at another aspect of the same story, which does touch on a perennial debate within journalism, but it's one which has become more universal and more complicated by the internet and social media. Every day's news cycle at the moment is throwing up a different defining image of the migration crisis. Some are heartwarming, most are heartrending. Today's is just horrible. It's a drowned toddler in a red shirt and blue trousers washed up on a Turkish beach. She's believed to be one of 12 Syrians who died trying to reach Greece. First of all, I'll ask you, Stefan, you're the picture editor on a newspaper or on a news website. Do you show the picture?
Very difficult decision. I've done those kind of decisions for 7 years when I was a responsible editor for the newsroom in Swedish radio, and as everybody else, we got a website. I think that after careful consideration, I would have published it, yes. Maybe one step down, so it would have to make an extra click.
A few outlets have done that. They've sort of pointed across the top, scroll down, but warning, distressing images. George, would you have run the picture?
Yes, I think I would, but I think it would have been a very close call. I remember a debate in a newspaper office once about whether or not we ran a picture of, this was after the tsunami had killed so many people in Sri Lanka and other places, of a hand of a body sticking out of the sand. The body had become covered in sand, and you couldn't identify the person. All you could see was the hand. It's a dilemma rather like that. But yes, I think by a small margin, it would have counted as really telling what this story cost.
This particular image, Stefan, and it is, I mean, it is incredibly powerful and it is incredibly haunting, but pictures in one context or another of dead people, of victims of tragedies, get disseminated and broadcast all the time. Why this? Why? What is so shocking, as you see it, about this? Well, not even shocking. What is it so, for want of a more neutral word, captivating, I guess, about this one?
It might be that it's a toddler. That's what makes this picture so dramatic and touches your heart immediately as you see it. I think that's it. On social media last week, there were a lot of pictures of dead children, but we never saw a discussion like around this picture that time. And I think it's because it's a very, very strong picture. I don't know, but I think it might be because it's a toddler.
George, on that subject, the dissemination of it on social media, and this one has been widely, and you could argue distressingly, spread on social media, does that add to the imperative on responsible media outlets to actually print it and give it a context, and thereby maybe mitigating against the possibility of it acquiring a life of its own and being removed from the context in which it was actually shot? I mean, basically, if people are looking at this thing anyway, are you therefore obliged to actually try and take control of the narrative slightly?
No, I think that's an overcomplicated way of looking at it, and I hope newsrooms aren't thinking that way. I think they are perfectly entitled and right sometimes not to do what social media will show. And the shooting of the young American TV journalist the other day in Virginia, I watched Channel 4 News, I think, and the BBC on the night that it happened, and they weren't running anything like what you could see on YouTube or social media either. And I think they were right to do that. They've got very big audiences. Those audiences do not expect them to do certain things. They can't ignore what social media are doing. They have to take it into account. But I don't think that means that they should always do the same thing.
What would be your take on that, Stefan? Because George then mentioned the images that did the rounds last week of those two poor journalists murdered in Virginia, and they were murdered by somebody who was actually attempting to create a spectacle, not just by killing them on live television, but by filming it with his own headcam. Would there have been any news justification for showing that footage, or would that just have been? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, did that story only become that big a story because there was footage of it? I mean, shooting murders are a daily occurrence in the United States.
Yeah. I do not agree wholeheartedly about when it comes to the criticism of showing this. I think we've seen much, much worse during the years. But I would say it's a little bit hard to justify showing exactly how this happened, because there's more or less no message in those pictures, I think.
No, I mean, that's what I thought. There was no really wider story there other than the spectacle created by the gunman. Whereas in the case of the photograph we're discussing today, there clearly is a wider story. And just to return to this image we've been discussing, which, as I was saying before we came on air, rather puts me in mind of that famous photograph Kevin Carter took in Sudan of the vulture hovering next to the starving child. Is it possible, and I'll put this to each of you, you first, George, for an image, a single picture like this, to reframe a debate, to call, or you know, to prompt a wide-scale shift in public opinion?
Yeah, I think it can. One of the most famous news pictures taken in the 1960s, for example, was of, if I remember rightly, South Vietnamese military officer or policeman shooting somebody. And the still picture is at the very moment that he is shot in the head. I mean, it's a very violent, very nasty picture. But I think it had quite a large effect in America at the time. So it captured, I mean, this was it wasn't before the days of TV, but it was, of course, before the days of digital communications and social networks and so on. But it spread very, very widely, and it was seen by an awful lot of people, and I think it did change the mood a bit.
You're right. That did, I think, cause a lot of Americans to ponder, you know, exactly who they were fighting for and who they were fighting with in South Vietnam. Stefan?
There were two pictures, actually. By the way, it was the police chief of Saigon.
Indeed it was.
Yes. But the other one who is at least as strong as that one is the napalm burnt girl running on a on the road. So those two together definitely, I would say, have had an impact on the developments.
But do you think, even just sticking with that thought, that even now in our current media saturated age, where we're just bombarded, you know, pretty much our entire waking hours, if we choose to be, that one image can still have that kind of impact?
I think it's perfectly possible that this picture, when we look back on it in 10 years' time, will have had quite an impact, yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Stefan Sonning and George Brock. When we return, Mr. Putin goes to Beijing.
There's a new Monocle book weighing in at 400 pages that's packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. It's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are George Brock and Stefan Sonning. Now, President Vladimir Putin of Russia is arriving nowabouts in Beijing. The headline purpose of his visit is to attend China's commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the end of what is officially known as the Chinese People's Resistance Against Japanese Aggression, to which Russia did make a three-week-long contribution in Manchuria towards the finish thereof. Probably more significant, however, are the 20-odd economic agreements due to be signed between the two countries. George Brock, this is Putin's 13th visit to China since 2000. Before he left, he told Xinhua and TASS that relations between the two countries are at an historic peak. Is he right?
No, it's all complete nonsense. Russia is no longer even in the top 15 of China's trading partners. That's to do with the fact that China doesn't need so much Russian oil, basically, at such a high price. That's the main driver there. And these 20 agreements are all pifflingly small. The really big ones the Russians want, the Chinese are going very, very slowly about. So the gap between the rhetoric and what is actually happening is very, very wide.
Well, Stefan, I mean, as I was saying, it's Putin's 13th visit to China since 2000. I haven't done the exact maths, but pretty sure I'm right in saying that any given leader of the Chinese Communist Party has been to Moscow rather less often. Are we getting the sense that Russia needs China rather more than China needs Russia?
Absolutely. Now, that's true. Actually, I was an Asia correspondent in the middle of the 90s, and I remember very well reporting on Russian President Yeltsin. Rather intoxicated, visited his counterpart Jiang Zemin in China,
and at least he managed to get off the plane, which he failed to do on one celebrated occasion in Ireland.
Yeah, but we're talking about pictures, telling picture about Mr. Yeltsin giving Jiang Zemin a beer hug and trying to dance with him. That I would say was the first step towards a better relation between Russia and China. And in the statement after this meeting, they said that their aim was to create a more multipolar world that is counterbalanced to the United States' influence in the region. And let's not forget that I quite agree that economically it's not such a big deal, but let's not forget the military. They just last week, I think, they finished a giant, the joint naval exercise in the Pacific, and that also, I think, is a counterbalance to the American ambition to have a stronger presence in the Pacific, both military and economically.
George, Vladimir Putin obviously was trying to put a positive spin on this in his discussions with TASS and Xinhua. And I think also, just going back to Stefan's point, I think at least on this occasion, Xi Jinping can probably feel reasonably secure that Vladimir Putin, of all people, isn't going to attempt to hug him. He's probably a more relaxing guest than Boris Yeltsin in that respect.
No, but Putin is very good at public relations, and PR, him trying to do that, a man that small trying to do that, it would be a disaster.
But Putin was, to the extent that Putin ever does appear to be trying to put a positive spin on anything, did note in the same interview that Russia and China trade was obviously not affected by Western sanctions over the Ukraine thing. And he went on to say that this encourages our domestic business to develop stable business ties with China. Does Russia really have anything that, does Russia sell anything that China really wants to buy?
It sells gas and it sells oil, and the Chinese are still buying that, and the Chinese are big consumers of both. But like I say, these things are really going extremely slowly. In terms of the mood music, and in terms, to some extent, of the military exercises, the kind that Stefan was talking about just now, yes, making America feel and the West feel uncomfortable is fine. They both like doing, they have a shared interest in doing that. That's quite fun. But, you know, is it really that close, is it really that close an alliance? Can it really be that close an alliance unless the Chinese decide for some reason or other that they're going to give Putin what he desperately needs? Putin's, you know, big aims are to get the Russian economy back up off the floor.
Well, China's big concern at the moment, of course, Stefan, is getting the Chinese economy back up off the floor. How nervous would or should Russia be about the state of China's economy?
Quite a bit, I would say, because China is, it's a lot of discussion now if even the 7% that the government of China says that their growth rate is not correct. It might be perhaps half, 3.5% or 4%. And since China now is the second biggest economy in the world, it's hugely important, especially when it comes to raw materials like metals, like oil, for example. And what happens there is very, very much influencing all the rest of the world, including, of course, Russia. And we have seen a lot of negative figures coming out of China the last couple of weeks, and we all know what happened to the exchange in Shanghai, and it's every day now again propped up by government money, and this can't go on. So the question is, will China be able to make a soft landing? They are trying to get the growth rate down. It is very, very difficult to do. You might end up with what's called an overshooting, that you try to adjust down, but you adjust too low. And that is a big risk for the rest of the world, and especially for Russia, I would say.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we should look at Egypt, and other parts. But Egypt recently reiterated its status as one of the world's toughest news beats by upholding the bizarre and ridiculous convictions of three Al Jazeera journalists. But for one group of Egyptian reporters, that beat has just become even tougher. The privately owned newspaper Al Tahrir, noted for its criticism of the regime, closed at the weekend. Some 400 of its journalists have begun a sit-in by way of protest, amid suspicions that political pressure may have been involved. George, first of all, why are, and it is a defining characteristic of all tyrannies and tyrants and regimes tending in that direction. We will talk about Turkey shortly. Why are they so sensitive?
I think that the people who currently run Egypt under President Sisi take the view that they are in a number of different wars on different fronts, if you like, and one of those fronts is an information war. they really do not care what people outside think. They are really just concerned that people are nudged, threatened, frightened, intimidated into not doing what they don't like. I don't think it's complicated. It's not nice, but I don't think it's complicated.
I mentioned the Stefan, Turkey, which is one of the world's leading imprisoners of journalists. It has locked up a few more this week, or in the last few days, a news crew from Vice who were filming in Diyarbakir. They've currently been charged with the charges are so silly they barely merit repeating. But when Turkey does something like that, locks up a foreign news crew, and therefore attracts an awful lot of almost universally negative foreign press attention, assuming that the regime and the police working for it are behaving with any sort of logic, at least from their own point of view, what are they trying to accomplish when they do that? What effect do they hope it will have?
They're trying to scare journalists, of course. That's almost always the case in situations like this. Make us apply self-censorship to our work there. That, I think, is the main reason. But let me also be, if I can,
please,
be a little bit of a devil's advocate here. There are a few problematic things in the case against these three journalists. Obviously, the reason for it is that the fixer is the guy who organizes and things and interprets for foreign journalists. He obviously, according to the authorities, had a encryption program in his laptop that is used by ISIL or IS. It's very difficult to understand why all three of them were arrested, but it might, and this is the devil's advocate again, it might be a problem with a fixer, which always in situations like this is very, very difficult for journalists.
George, the particular instance we're discussing there, the locking up and charging of the news crew from Vice, does there appear to be, at least as far as it's possible to tell, we really only have the word of the Turkish authorities for anything to it, or does it strike you as that straightforward case of attempting to intimidate the media?
I think if you stretch a point, you can say that if somebody is using encryption software, which is only otherwise used by people from ISIS or ISIL, then that might be something which the authorities would take a legitimate interest in, but it probably wouldn't take competent policemen very long to work out whether or not the man had a real connection to a terrorist organization, in which case that should be the end of the case. And as Stefan said, it doesn't make it obvious why the journalists who probably weren't using the encryption software were arrested as well. So I don't think it's very easy. In fact, I don't think it's possible to find much justification for what the Turkish authorities have done on what we know so far.
But Stefan, trying to look at it from the point of view of these regimes, doesn't it inevitably backfire upon them? Doesn't it just end up attracting more attention from around the world to whatever it was they were trying to stop the reporters from reporting in the first place?
And not always. I mean, look at where it's gone really, really bad. For example, in ISIS-controlled areas, we have stopped reporting from there almost everyone, all journalists from the whole world, because it's impossible. Because otherwise, we it's a possibility that we would get killed. So I think it's quite possible that this intimidation trick actually work.
Okay, well, we will have to leave it there for today. Stefan Sonning and George Brock, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's episode. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Federico Romaniello and Aidan McLaughlin. Our studio manager was Chad Chalvers. For the next half hour, you'll hear music from Monocle's international playlist. At 1900 hours, Daniel Giacopelli is in with the entrepreneurs. At 2200, the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.